run. Yeah, listening to the Divided Kingdom, I'm Lou Caramelli. And this is a program that has a Christian emphasis and covers some of the lesser-known stories that are of interest. The big networks do a pretty decent job, at least some of them do, some of the time, of covering the big stories. And, of course, the last few days, it's been nothing about, well, not nothing, but the emphasis has been on Maduro's capture and Venezuela and all that sort of thing. And that's pretty much ruled out other stories. And I'm not going to go into that deeply today because it's a fast-changing story. By the time you hear this, this is a pre-recorded program, and even though it's only a day or two before, things will change. But I'll give you a few things that you may not have heard quite so much of on the mainstream media. You can hear this program, by the way, on WWCR.com, Worldwide Christian Radio, Thursday evenings at 8 p.m. on a frequency of 4.840 megahertz. You can hear it repeated. If you can't make it Thursday evening, the program repeats Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. on a frequency of 7.490 megahertz. You can also go to my website, DividedKingdomRadio.com, DividedKingdomRadio.com, and you can go to the archives and hear the programs anytime you feel like it. So there are multiple ways. There's also KStarTalkRadio.com. Our webmistress, Angel, maintains that website. It has a lot of good programs, and you can find it. I'm not 100% sure of the time when this program is broadcast, but it's there, and if you go to that website, kstartalkradio.com, you'll be able to find it, and a lot of other good programs. Some are repeats of older programs from Dr. Stan Monteith. Any of you that have been listening to alternative radio for any length of time know all about Dr. Stan. Sadly, he's no longer with us. He died several years ago, but he had some wonderful programs. And if you're not familiar with him, a lot of those programs are probably still very much apropos, and you might want to check that out. KStarTalkRadio.com. Now, let's see what we have for today's news and some of the lesser-known items. Here's one from the New York Post on January 8th. The program will be broadcast January 8th, but the article appeared on January 5th, which, if I'm not mistaken, was Monday. And the title says, "Residents of New York City's Little Caracas celebrate Maduro's ouster." And here's a quote, "Been waiting for this moment for 26 years, unquote. And this article, as I said, was from the New York Post by Sophia Posnansky and Zoe Hussein. Locals in a bustling Queens, that is the Queens section of New York City, locals in a bustling Queens hub for the Venezuelan community celebrated the United States capture and removal of their homeland's longtime dictator. Residents of the city's Little Caracas, a stretch of Roosevelt Avenue that runs through the predominantly Spanish-speaking neighborhoods of Jackson Heights, Elmhurst, and Corona, told the Post that the capture of former President Nicolas Maduro on Saturday was a long-awaited moment of reckoning. And it shows a picture of Eric Gonzalez, a 41-year-old car salesman who lives in Queens. And this is a quote from Eric Gonzalez. "It's amazing news because we've been suffering with this guy for a long time. So it's been more than 26 years that we've been waiting for this," said Eric Gonzalez, a 41-year-old car salesman from Queens. And he went on, "So now that the U.S. Army went all the way over there to take him out, that makes us all so, so happy." And he said that of the moment Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were flown to the States and indicted on a slew of federal charges. Gonzalez is originally from the northwestern Venezuelan city of Maracaibo and has been living in the U.S. for 10 years. He fled the country in 2015, both over his opposition to Maduro's authoritarian regime and to seek better economic opportunities. He continued, "For me, it was always so dangerous to go back, because I was always against this. So every single person that is against it is in danger," unquote. Yesterday, his mother, who remains in Venezuela, called Gonzalez crying about what he described as a moment of hope. Gonzalez said, quote, "She was crying. My mom was crying in praise. She was like, we can't believe it. We were waiting for this for so long. You have no idea," unquote. And here's another Venezuelan exile, Duvin, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Duvin Flores, 19-year-old waiter at El Budari Cafe, excuse my Spanish, that's ELBUDARE Cafe. Duvin said that a party of roughly 50 people celebrating Maduro's ousting spontaneously erupted at the Roosevelt Avenue eatery on Saturday. Flores said, quote, "Yesterday, this was a party right here. Many people came, and they celebrated," unquote. The waiter moved to the U.S. from Venezuela nearly 3 years ago and now lives in Jackson Heights. "The 60-year-old grandmother remains in the country," he said. And Flores continued, "People come from different countries, not only Venezuela. We have been waiting for this moment for 26 years, and we can see the liberty in Venezuela, the freedom," Flores said. The operation to capture Maduro, page 63 and Flores, 69, began at around 10:46 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Friday, when President Trump gave the final order for the U.S. to attack. The dictator was carted across the Caribbean via helicopter, amphibious assault ship, and military plane on Saturday, with a stint at Guantanamo Bay before arriving in New York City to face a litany of federal charges. Federal prosecutors have accused Maduro of leading a, quote, corrupt, illegitimate government that for decades has leveraged government power to protect and promote illegal activity, including drug trafficking, unquote, according to his indictment. He allegedly partnered with violent drug traffickers and narco terrorists to bring upwards of 250 tons of cocaine into the U.S. by 2020, prosecutors said. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, are being held in Brooklyn's infamous Metropolitan Detention Center and are awaiting an arraignment in federal court on Monday. And of course, that arraignment has not taken place as I record this program. All right, that again was from the New York Post, January 5th. The title was "Residents of New York City's Little Caesar," take that back, "Little Caracas, celebrate Maduro's ouster." Now, here's a curious thing that I hadn't heard before. Of course, when my wife was still living, we canceled our cable TV because we hardly ever watched it, and we're paying over $1,000 a year for it. So we figured, why pay that kind of money for something without even watching more than, say, an hour a week, if that. So I'll admit, maybe this got by me, but I didn't see it in any newspaper clippings, and I've been, as I do each week, I've been going through some of the various newspapers, online editions, and trying to find out some good stories. This one caught my eye. Came from LifeSite News, LifeSiteNews.com, by Miles Allman, on the January 5th. And the title said, "Maduro's capture raises questions of U.S. election fraud linked to Venezuelan voting machines." Uh-huh. Notice it says U.S. election fraud. All right, the article reads, "With indications of multiple motivations for the U.S. attack on Venezuela and capture of President Nicolas Maduro circulating in the West, proposals have also emerged suggesting the Trump administration is additionally addressing election fraud crimes that many allege originate from the South American nation. Since at least 2004, concerns of fraudulent voting systems emanating from a company associated with Venezuelan nationals and at least partially owned by their government have appeared sporadically in media both locally and abroad in the United States. According to a CNN report at the time, and let me just interrupt there, CNN is not noted for supporting anything Trump does, but here at least, sounds like they're telling the truth. According to a CNN report at the time, the Venezuelan government owned 28% of Bista, I guess is how you say it, B-I-S-T-A, a company that adapted software for voting machines manufactured by Smartmatic, a corporation also owned by businessmen from that nation. Smartmatic reportedly advanced into the United States with the purchase of competitor Sequoia and grew into what is described as a labyrinth of international holding companies owned by Venezuelan businessmen. The mainstream outlet provided testimony asserting that these voting machines manipulated results, providing Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez with votes to remain in power during successive elections. Speculations have also been encouraged by a letter released early last month from the former director of military intelligence of Venezuela, alleging that Smartmatic machines have been used to keep that nation's government in power and were also provided to the United States as well. And this is a quote from this man who was a former three-star general, Hugo Carvajal Barrios. Again, I apologize for my poor Spanish. So the general wrote, quote, Smartmatic was born as an electoral tool of the Venezuelan regime, but soon derived into a tool to help keep the regime stay in power forever. The Smartmatic system can be altered. This is a fact. This technology was later exported abroad, including to the United States. Regime operatives maintain relationships with election officials and voting machine companies inside your country, he affirmed. He also said, I do not claim that every election is stolen, but I state with certainty that the elections can be rigged with the software and have been used. I think there's a word left out, and it probably should read, and it has been used to do so, meaning to rig the elections. And that's the end of the quote. Now, the author of the article says it must, however, be acknowledged that Carvajal's letter was issued from an American federal prison where he awaits sentencing for the crime of narco-terrorism conspiracy that he pleaded guilty to in June. As reported by the Dallas Express that broke the story, quote, if federal prosecutors deem his cooperation, in a quote, substantial assistance, it could reduce his sentencing exposure, unquote. That's what the Dallas Express said. With this in mind, at least one commentator observed that Carvajal had adopted Trump strategy, Trump campaign themes, such as election fraud, in his letter as an effective approach to win favor and have his sentence reduced. Also, indicating that easily rigging voting machines coming from Venezuela were on the mind of President Donald Trump at this time, are two of his recent reposts on Truth Social addressing the issue. The first demonstrates how similar voting systems from a company called Dominion can be easily rigged, while the second recalls a testimony by widely respected former CIA analyst Michael Schur, S-C-H-E-U-E-R, addressing that the 2020 election had been manipulated electronically by these same machines. This at least amounted to foreign interference in the American election, since Dominion is a Canadian company, which was storing data in Germany and Spain as well, he said, adding, quote, part of the Central Intelligence Agency, unquote, was likely behind the rigging of the 2020 election as well. In a Monday comment on the capture of Maduro, Schur opined that the Venezuelan president may be, quote, a key to finally bringing its closure to the rigged elections America has suffered through since at least 1920, unquote. Since he, that would be Maduro, and his lieutenants are reported to be in charge of producing the vote counting machines that have been used for fixing U.S. elections. And that's all part of a quote. And his testimony in this regard could be decisive. That is Maduro's testimony. Back a couple sentences, or the beginning of that long sentence, it said America has suffered through these election rigging since 1920. I'm wondering if that should have said 2020, but I'm not sure. Definitely in the article, it reads 1920. At any rate, Dominion voting machines have been under investigation for malfunctioning in states like Michigan due to concerns during the 2020 and 2024 elections. There were multiple claims regarding the faulty nature of Dominion voting machines in 2020, to the extent the company was so concerned about its product's reputation that it sued many commenters and even settled a suit with Fox for hundreds of millions of dollars. The United States government captured Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, early Saturday morning, and we already read that, so I'll stop there. Just one other sentence. The captives were transported to New York, where they will face drugs and weapons charges, according to U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi. And that is a curious thing. So the author is very cautious about that, not wanting to be sued, I'm sure. But this three-star general from Venezuela at least is saying that these machines could have been used to create fraud in American elections. Whether they were or not, we don't know. But that was some LightSide News, LightSideNews.com, by Miles Allman, Monday, January 5th, just a few days back. A lot of this is breaking news, and I don't go into this in great depth because it's changing so fast. Anything I say today in this pre-recorded program could easily be obsolete 2 days later. Well, now we switch to Fox News, and another big story that was breaking Monday when I was at the library, it was breaking as fast as I could type, and it said, fraud followed forces Democratic Governor Tim Walz to abandon Minnesota re-election bid. This is by Paul Steinhauser and Andrew Mark Miller of Fox News, and it was, as I said, January 5th, Monday. Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota announced on Monday that he's dropping his bid for a third term as governor amid stinging criticism of the unsuccessful 2024 Democratic vice presidential nominee's handling of his state's massive welfare assistance fraud scandal. Walz charged in a statement, quote, "The political gamesmanship we're seeing from Republicans is only making that fight harder to win. But as I reflected on this moment with my family and my team over the holidays, I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all." And the governor added, quote, "Every minute I spend defending my own political interests would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who prey on our differences. So I've decided to step out of the race and let others worry about the election while I focus on the work," the governor announced. And this is Lou speaking. This sounds so noble, doesn't it? But you can bet he'd be in that race if he could. But he knows the handwriting is on the wall. Well, back to the article. Walz launched his bid for a third four-year term as Minnesota governor in September, but in recent weeks has been facing a barrage of incoming political fire from President Donald Trump and Republicans, and some Democrats, over the large-scale theft in a state that has long prided itself on good governance. And I'll just comment. I'll interrupt for a minute. This is Lou. If you heard the program last week, I went into some detail about all the accusations, the video that had surfaced about all these Somalis having allegedly stolen vast amounts of money in the billions, with a B, of dollars. So I won't go into all that again, but it does mention that here. Back to the article, more than 90 people, most of Minnesota's live Somali community, have been charged since 2022 in what has been described as the nation's largest COVID-era scheme. How much more money has been stolen through alleged money laundering operations involving fraudulent meal and housing programs, daycare centers, and Medicaid services is still being tabulated. But the U.S. attorney in Minnesota said the scope of the fraud could exceed $1 billion. Billion with a B. Not million. Billion. Prosecutors said that some of the dozens that have already pled guilty in the case used the money to buy luxury cars, real estate, jewelry, and international vacations. But some of the funds also sent overseas and potentially into the hands of Islamic terrorists. Oh, I've got to interrupt again. This is Lord speaking. That doesn't sound like poor people who are refugees who are trying to start a new life in the USA to me. They know all about how to buy luxury cars, how to buy real estate, what jewelry is worth money, and international vacations, and then giving some of the money away potentially to terrorists. Well, doesn't sound like your typical refugee who's fleeing a corrupt government, but then again, under the Biden administration, anybody could get in for any reason whatsoever, is what I have always heard. Well, back to the article. Now, Walz is, of course, trying to cover up things. He says, this is on my watch. I am accountable for this. And more importantly, I am the one that will fix it. Walz told reporters last month as he took responsibility for the scandal. The governor took actions to stop some of the suspected fraudulent payments and ordered an outside audit of Medicaid billing in the state. But Trump repeatedly blasted Walz as incompetent and during Thanksgiving used a slur for developmentally disabled people to describe the governor. The scandal, which grabbed plenty of national attention over the past 2 months, went viral the past few weeks following the release of a video by 23-year-old YouTube content creator Nick Shirley, who alleged widespread fraud at Somali-run daycare centers. And days later, the Trump administration froze federal child care funding to Minnesota. And, this is Lou again, putting my little comment in. If you've seen this video, he goes up to certain daycare centers, asks about them, makes a claim that he has a child that he wants to get into the daycare, and they more or less say, we don't have any, or we can't help you, or words of that effect. Now, anybody knows private daycare, just like private schools, and I taught at a private school for several years. In fact, two of them. They always are anxious to get new customers, new students, so that they would, it's inconceivable that they would turn away this man just because they already have all the students they can handle. Well, if you haven't seen the video, it's well worth watching. And I think if you just type in Minnesota daycare video, do a little search. I shouldn't think it would be very hard to find, even now. Okay, a little bit more on the scandal. That, by the way, again, was from Fox News, January 5th, about Governor Tim Walz being forced to abandon his re-election bid. I personally think that two terms is enough for anybody until the days of Franklin D. Roosevelt in the middle of World War II in Europe. No president ever served more than two terms. Washington kind of set the precedent for that. And to me, a governor should be happy with two terms. Let somebody else have a little chance to lead the state. But politicians love to hold on to their jobs. Well, now we're going to get to the Washington Times, one more point of view about this big scandal. Minnesota welfare scandal exposes the Democrats' kleptocratic ways. And the subtitle says this isn't about race, it's about welcoming unassimilable fraudsters, that is, those that won't assimilate. This is by Robert Knight, The Washington Times, Sunday, January 4th. And this is an opinion piece. The multi-billion dollar Somali welfare scandal in Minnesota continues to grow, even as Democrats do their best to tamp it down. Representative Ilhan Omar, who represents the Twin Cities areas and is a naturalized citizen from Somalia, lamented the fraud, but said the focus on Somalia was because of bigotry. She wrote a column for the New York Times accusing President Trump of hate speech and, quote, racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and division, unquote. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, who was sworn into office on a Koran instead of a Bible, called the Trump administration's recent order to end temporary protected status for Somali nationals an example of racism. And wearing a hijab, I always thought that was a G, but I guess it's hijab, H-I-J-A-B, that is the head covering. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, that, I'm interrupting again. That sounds more Irish. That doesn't sound like a Islamic person to me. But anyway, let me get back to the article. Wearing a hijab, Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, a.k.a. L. Flanagan, told a crowd at a Somali market, "We have your back." Somalis now number more than 107,000 in Minnesota, mostly in the Democrat-run area of Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Twin Cities. The scandal may involve as much as $9 billion stolen, according to the lead federal prosecutor in Minnesota. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is posing as a fraud-exposing superhero instead of what he really is, either a crook or a clueless political hack. Remember, Mr. Walz is the guy who said he was placed on the Kamala Harris ticket in 2024 as the vice presidential nominee, quote, because I could code talk to white guys watching football, fixing their truck, doing that. I could put them at ease, unquote. As part of his manly appeal, Mr. Walz ordered tampon dispensers to be placed in boys' bathrooms in public schools. Yes, he did. Despite the Democrats' insistence that there's nothing to see here, and that anyhow the fraud is nobody's fault, the story is growing. Late last month, independent YouTube journalist Nick Shirley ripped the cover off the scandal. His on-the-ground videos exposing phony child care centers in Minnesota, such as the one with the quality leering center sign, have gone viral with more than 125 million views. And as I mentioned the last week, one of the so-called daycare centers couldn't even spell the word learning. They just had L-E-A-R-I-N-G. Somehow they forgot the N in that word. But going on, in response, the Trump administration has announced even more aggressive investigations and a freeze on federal child care funding to the Gopher State. This is happening while the legacy media treat it as a non-story. They are too busy dishing out irrelevant dirt from the Jeffrey Epstein files. It's similar to the way fighter jets emit clouds of foil to confuse enemy radar. Beyond Minnesota, Americans know something is deeply wrong. This isn't just about illegal immigration or astronomical government fraud. It's about both. Many Americans are furious that they are not only losing their country to an alien culture because of one political party's greed for power, but they are also paying for it with their tax dollars. If they dare to complain, they are called racists. This isn't about race. It's about bringing in people with unassimilable cultural values, but then turn around and rip us off. Despite some local Minnesota media coverage back in 2022, the New York Times broke the story nationally that year about some Somalis milking safety net programs erected for the COVID-19 pandemic. And this is a little interrupting, but once I'll praise the New York Times that they had the guts to bring this out and didn't fear being called racist for it. Going on with the article, the FBI investigated groups overseen by Feeding Our Future, which billed the government tens of millions of dollars for non-existent meals. More than 75 people were arrested and charged. Other fraud schemes involved illicit Medicaid and housing payments and unfounded claims of autism, for which parents received kickbacks. In 2024, the scandal wasn't big enough to keep Mr. Walz off the Democratic ticket. By then, he was a super good fraud fighter and white male voter whisperer. Last month, thanks to Mr. Shirley, the far bigger scandal broke open. The Department of Homeland Security has sent teams to Minnesota to investigate how fraudsters, mostly in the Somali community, were getting rich off the taxpayers. The larger lesson here is something that Milton Friedman said in 1999. This is a quote from him. You cannot simultaneously have free immigration and a welfare state, unquote. Let me read that again. You cannot simultaneously have free immigration and a welfare state, unquote. Because Milton Friedman was an economist. He knows his business. Going on with the article, free benefits and an open border, as under President Biden, are magnets for an infinite stream of illegal aliens. This cannot be sustained. This was the actual goal of two socialist economists, Richard Cloward, C-L-O-W-A-R-D, and his wife, Frances Fox Piven, P-I-V-E-N. They crafted the Cloward-Piven strategy in the 1960s. Their idea was to overwhelm the welfare state with demands until it collapsed, forcing Americans to surrender to full-fledged socialism. Mr. Cloward has gone on to his reward, but Ms. Fox Piven, at age 93, is still pushing her stuff onto credulous academics and students. In June 2019, during the Democratic presidential primaries, the 10 candidates on stage, including Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris, were asked to raise their hands if they supported giving, quote, undocumented immigrants, unquote, access to government health care. All of them raised their hands. Right now, quote, unquote, free health care may not play as well. Obamacare has exponentially raised health care costs and health insurance premiums. Democrats are threatening again to shut down the government in late January if taxpayer subsidies are not renewed for their free stuff army. In light of the burgeoning Minnesota scandal, the giveaways may be losing public support. In an ex post quoted in National Review, former Washington Post reporter David Weigel said, quote, welfare liberalism can't win if voters believe that money is being stolen, and the liberals will let it happen to avoid being called racist, unquote. That was exactly what happened in Minnesota, and undoubtedly in a lot of other places. This will keep hitting the fan as the Justice Department and the FBI look at more states that have had Democratic one-party rule for decades, such as California and Illinois. Just imagine what's under some of those rocks. And that again was an opinion piece in the Washington Times, dated Sunday, January 4th, titled Minnesota Welfare Scandal Exposes the Democrats' Kleptocratic Ways, as in kleptomania. All right. One other little more humorous note, that goes along with that was at the Gateway Pundit. And the title reads, Beyond Parody, Craigslist ad from a daycare center in Minneapolis seeks to hire 20 child actors. This is by Mike LaChance, January 5th, 2026. And they actually show a little photocopy of the post, although I don't see the exact thing here. It may not have copied well from the original on the internet. But it reads, this is just too funny to be real. A poster on Craigslist in the city of Minneapolis is supposedly from a daycare center that is looking to hire up to 20 child actors. Since anyone can post something on the marketplace, message board, website, it could be from anyone. But given the intellect of the Minnesota, that is Minneapolis, fraudsters we have seen in recent weeks, they may very well be real. In their defense, they are at least offering good money for the actors they seek to hire. PJ Media reported as follows. Is a Minneapolis daycare trying to hire child actors on Craigslist? Either a Minneapolis daycare is actually trying to hire child actors to restart taxpayer funding, or someone is playing a truly extraordinary practical joke on Craigslist users. A listing posted several days ago on Craigslist from, and this is in quotes, Help Us Daycare, unquote, actually advertises a desire to hire, quote, child actors for a three-day contract. And it has in parentheses Ventura Village. I guess that's the name of the alleged daycare center. The listing claims the daycare lost state funding due to, quote, white supremacy, unquote, and asserts that it needs to hire 20 child actors for a few days to show up to the fake daycare because the, and this is also a quote, the entire client base has already found new daycare services, unquote. So when the state investigators arrive, the listing explains, kids need to be on site. The listing seems too insane to be sincere. On the other hand, when you consider the craziness uncovered in the Minnesota Somali daycare fraud investigation, perhaps this entry warrants a little government scrutiny. Well, there's more to this, but it's, I'll just read a concluding sentence or two. It's like something straight out of the pages of the Babylon Bee. If it's a practical joke, it's pretty funny. If it's real, it's just sad. Again, that was at the Gateway Pundit on January 5th, and the title was Beyond Parody, Craigslist ad from a daycare center in Minneapolis seeks to hire 20 child actors. Well, that's one way to get some children in daycare. Hire them and pay the parents. Well, I tend to think, this is Lou speaking now, I tend to think that's just a big joke. But you never know. It's hard to tell. Now, one of my listeners had a good comment. I ought to expose some of the corruption in my, what is now my native state. Well, I don't know if that's the right word. The state I now live in and have for the past 50-odd years, Maryland, because Massachusetts was my original home state. And both states have had their share of corruption over the years, and some good governments as well. And unlike some states, as I looked in the records, both of these states have had a lot of Republican as well as Democratic governors. But I will say this, for some time now, the Maryland legislature has been pretty much ruled by the Democratic Party. The Republicans are the loyal opposition, but that's all. And the Democrats pretty much push through anything they feel like pushing through the legislature in Maryland. And I'm not that familiar with Massachusetts, so I won't comment too much on there. Although the governor certainly has gotten herself in a mess in Massachusetts, as I've read several good articles that people have sent me concerning this, and this is not entirely her fault, this law that says they've got to give housing to everybody in the state of Massachusetts has boomeranged. It was originally intended as a compassionate law that I don't think anybody objected greatly to for the very few homeless people back in the, I don't know, the 1980s or 1990s, sometime around there. And at that time, it was a comparatively small number of people that were serviced by this law and the consequent housing. But, like Milton Friedman said, when you mix the welfare state with unlimited illegal immigration, something's got to give. And in the last couple of years, Massachusetts has found itself swamped, totally swamped. They've had to use Logan International Airport as one place, or at least that was whether the state did that or whether just the illegal immigrants plunked themselves down, I don't know. But they certainly have used several older hotels, motels, such places as that, even as some government buildings, is my understanding, to house the immigrants. So you see, I don't blame the governor entirely for it, but I don't think she's been pushing very hard to get the law changed. And with all the Democrats in power there, maybe that's hopeless. But I don't think the citizens of Massachusetts are too happy. But then again, if they keep electing Democrat governors, that's what's going to happen. Now, here in Maryland, I must admit, I haven't had time since this listener gave me that good comment. I haven't had time to gather up some information about corruption here in the state of Maryland. I don't think it's as bad as in some states. Our Governor Wes Moore, of course, is a Democrat. But I will take some time over the next week. And hopefully next week I can give you a little summary of what I find out about corruption in Maryland. Maryland, unfortunately, is pretty much a Democrat state as far as the legislature goes, as I said a few minutes ago, simply because big cities tend to vote Democrat. And in Maryland, the population centers are Baltimore and the suburbs surrounding Washington, D.C. They tend to vote Democrat and outvote the rest of the state. The Eastern Shore, that is those counties to the east of Chesapeake Bay, where I live, and the more westerly counties, which is geographically by far the biggest part of the state. But population-wise, it's much smaller than Baltimore and Greater Washington. So, with that in mind, I will look into that over the next week and see what I can dig up. All right. Now we go into a matter of crime, fighting crime. And this appeared on Fox News. It seems like a fairly well-balanced article. The title says, "What happened after the country's most dangerous law," that's in quotes, "most dangerous law went into effect?" Here are the numbers. This has to do with eliminating cash bail entirely in the state of Illinois. It's by Alba. And again, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the names here. Alba Shubas Fantazi and Nicholas Lannan, January 6, 2026. More than 2 years after Illinois eliminated cash bail under the Safety Act, that's SAFE-T Act, statewide crime data shows no increase in violent crime. But law enforcement leaders in rural parts of the state say the reform has created new public safety and addiction treatment challenges that statistics alone do not capture. The Illinois Safety Act, and that stands for Safety, Accountability, Fairness, and Equity Today. The Safety Act was passed in January 2021 and signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker the next month. Its most controversial provision, the end of cash bail under the Pretrial Fairness Act, took effect September 18, 2023, after the Illinois Supreme Court upheld the law's constitutionality. The supporters argued the reform would prevent low-risk defendants from being jailed simply because they could not afford bail. Opponents warned it would lead to repeat offenses, failures to appear in court, and harm to victims of crime. In a previous interview, Mayor Keith Pekau, P-E-K-A-U, of Orland Park, a Chicago suburb, told Fox News, "When I said that this is the most dangerous law I've ever seen, I believe that." A year later, statewide data largely undercuts those warnings. But some sheriffs say the law is worsening conditions for communities already struggling with addiction and limited treatment access. Research from Loyola University of Chicago Center for Criminal Justice shows that between September 2023 and September 2024, violent crime in Illinois declined by about 6%, while homicides fell by about 10%. Property crime rose by less than 1% statewide. Failure to appear in court rates also remains stable at around 15%, consistent with pre-reform levels. Research found no statistically significant increase in reoffenses among defendants released under the new risk-based pretrial system. And I'm going to skip down in the interest of time. Cook County, which of course includes the Illinois suburbs, which sharply, that is to say the Chicago suburbs, but sharply curtailed the use of cash bail years before the statewide reform, saw slightly lower rearrest rates and improved court appearances, appearance outcomes after 2023, according to Loyola University and Cook County court data. But in southern and rural Illinois, some law enforcement officials said the Safety Act fails to address the realities of addiction-driven crime, especially in areas with limited access to treatment. Franklin County Sheriff Kyle Bacon said, quote, "I don't think the Safety Act serves the public." And he's a 25-year law enforcement veteran whose county sits roughly 300 miles south of Chicago. Bacon said deputies routinely arrest people who are, quote, "high on methamphetamines or fentanyl," unquote, only to see them booked and released within minutes. He noted that under the new law, drug possession alone is no longer a detainable offense unless it involves additional charges such as firearms or distribution crimes. And Sheriff Bacon said, quote, "We bring them into the jail, book them in, and immediately book them out without even an hour of clean time. They come in high, they leave high. And I ask myself often, how does that serve the public and how does that serve those people? It does not." Well, in the interest of time, we're going to have to cut this one short. That gives you the gist. So I would say at this point, there are pros and cons. This is a well-balanced article that does give both sides of the argument. One other thing Bacon says, he says, quote, "Some people say addiction is a victimless crime. I don't believe that. Our burglaries, our thefts, our property crimes, the vast majority are driven by addiction." And he adds, "People say, the police let them go." But he added, "We're just as frustrated. We work within the law. But when someone is victimized and arrest is made, and the defendant walks right back out the door, that doesn't feel like justice to victims." And police unions and prosecutors were among the strongest opponents of the Safety Act and backed the lawsuit, but it did not win in the Illinois Supreme Court. All right, let's lay that aside for a few minutes. I got a couple of things that were sent to me by my loyal listener from Massachusetts. Let me see what we have here. Here's one about our ex-president, William Jefferson Clinton. This appeared in the New York Post on December 24th, 2025. And this was a letter to the editor that says, "Well, look here. Bill Clinton frolicking around Epstein Island with young girls." And he's referring to an article that appeared in the New York Post on the front page that said Tubba Bubba. I don't know the date. It's too small print to see. But it was not too long ago. And the subtitle said, Clinton Frolics with Mystery Girls in Epstein File Dump. Back to the letter to the editor. Who'd have thunk? Dirtbags hang with dirtbags, and it's tough to find two bigger dirtbags than Clinton and Jeffrey Epstein. Remember, this is the man who did not inhale and did not have sex with that woman and did not engage in any degenerate activity on Epstein's island. We are not fools, Phil. We know you. That was from a reader to the New York Post. What else do we have? Is an article from Howie Carr. This would have been from the Boston, Massachusetts Herald, December 24th, entitled DEI Hazmat Crew Needed at Brown University. DEI cleanup in aisle 51. DEI cleanup in aisle 51. Stat. Go woke, go broke. Brown University is just the latest so-called elite institution to learn the hard way that it's never a good idea to get rid of merit hiring and instead rely on that PC Democrat clown posse that was doing slapstick on live TV Thursday night in Providence. And now the supercilious Ivy League twits try to dodge the consequences of their woke follies. And they're talking about, of course, Brown University. Jumping down a little bit now, they talk about, let's see now, Zachary Cunha, during the Biden administration, he was the U.S. attorney for woke, Rhode Island. Well, it goes on. This Cunha wasn't hired just because he went to Brown. Anybody can go to Brown as long as they either check enough protected class boxes or have billionaire parents who can pick up the $93,000 annual tab. Now, Cunha was hired because he already knows how to groom a DEI scandal. And I'll stop there because we just don't have time to read the whole article. But the idea is because Brown is typical of so many places that, so many colleges at least, that if you are a minority of the right type, you will get fired fast. Or admit it fast if you're a student. Oh, here's a little something that should wet your whistles. And let me preface it by saying, are you living paycheck to paycheck? Are you a little short on money? Well, Joe Biden will receive, this is the title, Joe Biden will receive a record pension of $417,000 annually as former president, funded by U.S. taxpayers, surpassing the presidential salary and doubling Obama's pension. This is by Joanna Campos. And I believe this was Fox News. Somehow I left that out here. I'm pretty sure it was. And it says this figure even exceeds his presidential salary of $400,000. It's $417,000 for the pension. And doubles the approximately $200,000 that Barack Obama receives in his retirement, highlighting a benefit system that rewards longevity in public office at the expense of the national treasury. Biden gets the largest pension of any ex-president in U.S. history, $417,000. And here's a quote. It's pretty unusual, historically unusual, to have such a large pension amount, says an expert from the National Taxpayer Union Foundation to the New York Post. Oh, this was probably to the New York Post. That would be the source. According to a detailed analysis for the National Taxpayer Union Foundation, this record amount arises from a unique combination. The standard pension for former presidents, set at around $230,000 annually, plus the benefits accumulated under the Civil Service Retirement System for 36 years as a senator from Delaware and 8 as vice president. Now, I'm going to go off my high horse here. What does any man or woman, how can they justify being a senator for 36 years? Somehow, I don't think the Founding Fathers envisioned that. And to me, that's a sure example of why we might want to have some kind of term limits. These guys get in there, or women in some cases, and just sit around milking the system for all it's worth. Yes, he served the government. He also did a great many disservices during his 4 years as president, or claiming to be president. Somehow I get the distinct impression, as do so many people, that he was not in charge, or at least not always in charge. And just jumping down to a couple of key points here, Biden, who presented himself as a middle-class Joe, accumulated a personal fortune estimated in millions during his service, including properties in Delaware valued at more than $4 million, which questions the austerity narrative promoted by his party. In comparison, former presidents like Donald Trump waived their presidential salary, donating it to public causes, a gesture not emulated by Biden. All right. Well, as you can see, my opinion of Joe Biden is not high. Well, thank you for listening. If you'd like to write to me, write to Blue Cavalry, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. If I got to tell you that, that has slipped my mind. But I'll give it again next week. So tune in again next week for some all-new stories. And thank you for listening. Have a great week. Good night.